Hello there. Welcome to this episode of Bridging the Gaps. I'm your host, Dr. Waseem Akhtar. Today I'm joined by W. Russell Newman, a professor of media technology at New York University. He is a specialist in new media and digital education. He's a founding faculty of the MIT Media Lab. He served as the senior policy analyst in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, working in the areas of information technology, broadband policy, and technologies for border security. Today, we are going to discuss his new book, Evolutionary Intelligence, How Technology Will Make Us Smarter. Russ, thank you very much for joining me and welcome to Bridging the Gaps.
Thank you very much.
Let us start with the concept that is at the core of this book, evolutionary intelligence. Russ, unpack this concept of evolutionary intelligence as you present in this book.
Well, we don't always appreciate technologies when they appear on the horizon. But over the last year or so, everybody's been talking about artificial intelligence. And my perspective is to say, let's take a step back and think about the other stages in the evolution of what is uniquely human in our existence on Earth. And it turns out that it was only about 10,000 years ago that we settled down on a physical location. Before that, for hundreds of thousands, in fact, millions of years, the prehumans and early humans were running around hunting and gathering, and basically were in fairly small bands or families. And what we did is we probably chased a few animals into a canyon and figured out how to keep them there and discovered that if we took some of these seeds and planted them in the ground, we could grow something. But it's literally for the last 1% of time on Earth that we've had the capacity to stay in one place by taking care of animals and growing our own crops. So that was a major change in our culture, and it allowed some people with extra food around to take time off and specialize in writing things down and inventing written language. And then ultimately the printing press, and later on we discovered machines that could substitute machine power for animal or human power. And so each of these was a stage in strengthening our capacity. So the machines made us stronger, and our invention of telecommunications allowed us to communicate across the globe. And each of them is a physical device that interacts with our physical environment. And now with artificial intelligence, we're dealing with how machines deal with ideas. And I think the real revolution is going to be in the capacity of these technologies to actually make us smarter. And by smarter, I mean help to compensate for the many errors that have evolved in human evolution. So if you think about, I always say, take a look at Wikipedia. They list 200 different cognitive biases, and I'm not sure they've caught them all. So I figure this is a chance, instead of modeling AGI, or artificial general intelligence, on human intelligence, which is a little bit self-centered, we should model it on intelligence broadly defined, especially to compensate for the many errors in the way we think about the world.
Russ, whenever there are new technologies, whenever there are new innovations, we are always concerned about those. And you mentioned printing press. When printing press was invented, there was huge concern that this machine, this system will produce books for masses. But masses perhaps didn't need books, there was a view. And there was a concern. And when internet came out and when internet was invented, we had similar concerns. Now, people are expressing concerns about artificial intelligence, and very smart people. Elon Musk has said that developing AI is like summoning the demon. Late Professor Hawking was very much concerned about AI, and he said something along the lines that perhaps that would be the last thing that we will develop. So there are so many concerns there. Now, you are very, very optimistic about this technology, and you're very, very positive about this technology, and even the title Evolutionary Intelligence. So you are just saying this is extension of ourselves, like we have developed other tools. What is at the core of this this positive view, this optimism?
Okay, there's another story there. The term artificial intelligence was invented by a very bright young professor at Dartmouth at the time, the summer of 1956, when John McCarthy summoned some colleagues to spend the summer up in Dartmouth thinking about what artificial intelligence could be. And it turned out that for the next 70 years, the capacity to get this achieved was very frustrating and elusive. It turns out that there were, although the concept made sense, there were three things that were missing for it to be practical and successful. The first was they didn't have enough computing power, and the term we use now is to say you want more compute. I think it's kind of compute, a cute way of putting it. The second thing, they didn't have the mathematical models like they do now with neural nets and some very sophisticated ways of dealing with large data sets. And the third thing they didn't have was access to large data sets to do the training for these neural nets. And so when all of those three things came together in the last couple of years, we've seen a massive change. So what McCarthy kept doing to try to generate funding, and the funding would get cut, and they called them AI winters, because many people left the field saying, well, it's just not happening, and the technology isn't there yet, or something's not there yet. And so they kept describing the technology as out there, like a robot, competing with a human because it could be as intelligent as the human. And so instead of describing it as a helper, a co-pilot, a capacity to augment human intelligence, they kept describing it as this neat, good thing out there. I mean, that's just the way engineers tend to think about their creations. So I think there was this misconception that, and of course, dramatists, you think of the HAL computer in the movie 2001, and the first and second Terminators movies, where the notion that the robots would want to take over the world. What I think is going on there, and something that I'm not persuaded by, is critics thinking anthropomorphizing these machines. It turns out that humans evolved in an environment of scarce resources, competing with other humans and other animals, and the natural evolution would lead to a pretty aggressive and competitive perspective. But computers didn't evolve that way, and I don't think a computer wants to eat your lunch. So I think that we have a tendency to say, well, those computers are going to act like us, and I think we can be very careful in our training processes so that they don't. Now, here's what your listeners need to do. They need to prepare a P-doom. That's capital P, paren, doom, and paren. And that is their probability that computers will eat our lunch and kill us all. And there's this very prominent spokesman named Eliezer Yudkowsky, who's gotten famous. And I haven't heard a sentence out of him that doesn't end with, and kill us all. He's very focused on that conclusion. And he's convinced himself, and I think some others, that the P-doom is one. It's just inevitable. But if you talk to the experts, they say, well, you know, something could go wrong. That's often the case. But that their P-dooms as a percentage between 0 and 1, a probability between 0 and 1, is usually around 0.01 or 0.02, which is, I think, worth paying attention to. I am convinced that these are issues we need to confront. But my concern is that bad guys with AI are going to do things that we need to be protected from, not that the AI is inherently inclined to, as they say, eat our lunch.
This nicely brings us to my next question. There is a view out there that some of these worries are about bad guys using this technology. And I was speaking with another guest on this podcast, and a very interesting point came up that if a technology can be used for a bad purpose, there is going to be someone out there who will find a way to use the technology for that bad purpose. So how do we stop that? So there are two different type of concerns. One concern is that the AI itself might harm us. But then the other concern is that AI in the hands of those people who will use it for bad purpose will harm us, because it's going to be very, very smart and powerful technology. So how can we mitigate that risk?
Well, one of the prominent concerns is the notion of misinformation, deep fakes and fake news. And my perspective is humans have been inventing false stories and fake news. I think it was the American author Mark Twain who said that a lie will get halfway around the world before the truth gets its boots on, which was true in a time when getting halfway around the world, you have to go by sailboat. So I think the propensity for those of us with various incentives to tell stories and make up stories and tell lies has been with us for a long time. In fact, the evolved human cognitive system has this theory of mind where we often examine the incentives of those with whom we're speaking to try to say, well, am I going to buy what that person is selling or not? And so my guess is that we will use our human capacities to be skeptical and judgmental about the various arguments that are put in front of us. And when it gets even more complex and sophisticated, we will have AI tools of our own to help sort out the truth from the falsity and the made-up pictures from the actual true representations of the world around us.
So you think that even those type of challenges that are creating worries in our mind, AI will actually help us to address those challenges?
The best defense about a bad guy with an AI system is a good guy with an AI system.
This reminds me about some other arguments about guns in the United States.
I'm not so sure I'm fully appreciative of the provenance of that line, but I think it makes some sense in this case.
Okay. Russ, another point that you mentioned a few moments ago was about biases. We human beings, we have our biases. And that's a problem. And you said that maybe AI will help us, that these biases are overcome and maybe those biases are not there. But research informs us that if we have a data set that we use to train an AI system, and if there are biases in that data set, the trained AI would have the same biases. So there are concerns that are being expressed that our biases will be there in AI.
That's true, of course. Some of the early examples were the fact that there was missing data from the training. And therefore, when certain issues came up, and this, I think, dealt with potential racial biases in various AI systems that were used for evaluating various systems for basically sorting humans. And so the lack of a full data set or a bias in omission is a demonstrable issue that can be found and can be corrected. And it turns out that I think before Elon Musk removed its availability, OpenAI, the company in San Francisco that's responsible for the GPT-3 and 4 and now 5 series, was using Twitter, now X, as one of their sources. And of course, there's all kinds of nonsense in the social media, and that's going to get picked up. So the first editions of these systems will reflect those various racial and ethnic animosities, among other biases. There's a whole set of sophisticated refinements to the system. And they're basically using AI to fix itself, to both acknowledge, recognize, and correct and limit the use of those kinds of, let's call it unlearning the biases. And so if we're not looking for them, there may be some unintended biases still there. And that would be, I think, a very important subject for further research.
Now, as you said, that we should prepare the data very carefully. We should make sure that data does not contain biases. Then it leads to the next point, that who will monitor that? Who will manage that? Who will oversee that? Who will regulate that? So it means that you are in favor of some regulations out there?
I think the best constraint would be the marketplace itself. So if you've got a system that's making errorful, biased judgments, then it'll be a less attractive system. So I'd much prefer that the marketplace, rather than some federal AI regulatory commission, that might spell out FAKE as an acronym, was out there trying to judge. And given how quickly these systems are moving, the notion that a slow-moving regulatory body would be able to make sense of and effectively regulate, I think, speaks to the unlikely success of such an enterprise. But if you talk about another kind of bias, which is everybody thinks they're going to win the lottery, so they throw a lot of money at a lottery investment. This is sometimes called the confirmation bias. We want to, when we see a little bit of evidence for something we want to believe, we weight that evidence more heavily than evidence of something we find uncomfortable. And so I think the AI systems would be in a position to say, be careful, you understand how much you want that to be true. Here's the best evidence we got, and it's not strongly leaning towards what you want. So perhaps the ultimate question of this notion of a augmented intelligence, a whole evolutionary intelligence stage of human existence is whether we'll take good advice when it's given to us.
Russ, some of us who have been following the development in the field of AI, when ChatGPT and when large language models came out, we were very much surprised when we saw their capabilities and when we saw them churning out large pieces of text. You have been following these developments also. When you first experimented with ChatGPT, when you saw its capabilities, were you taken aback?
I was delighted. And there's a story there too. Turns out that these gentlemen, mostly men, a few brave women, on 18th Street in the Market District of San Francisco decided to separate from Google and the other major tech firms and basically say, we're going to experiment with a whole set of new ideas and see if we can make this work after having tried all these other times. And a young kid said, I found this data set, which is recommendations. I don't know if it was like something like, I guess something like Amazon or one of the immense data systems where people are saying, I like this product, I don't like that product. And so he put in a trillion words into this system, which was had sufficient compute. And he had these new mathematical models that had just been invented. And they were stunned that this kid had come up with using just that one little data set of recommendations and reactions to product reactions. And so they said, well, let's put the full set of data into it. And that was the so they weren't even expecting it either. It was one of the guys with a bad haircut, five desks down in a cubicle, who had figured out something was working here. And they put the three things together, the math, the computing power, and the extremely large and diverse data sets. If you think about the number of parameters in these large language models, they're measured in the hundreds of millions and billions of parameters. Those are little estimates for reacting to the different words that are put in the front end in a prompt. And if you think about it, at 100 billion, that's the number of neurons in the human brain. So the fact that these things give a different answer to the same question, as a child will give a different answer to the same question, you've got now the complexities of different pathways through those matrices we call large language models. You're getting a human-like complexity to its reaction to its environment. So I'm delighted that that they discovered it really works when you get up to scale.
Russ, we all know that there is no as such intelligence behind these models. These are just probabilities, and that what is the next best word that the system should churn out? It finds that and then it churns out that word. And to us, it feels that maybe there is an intelligence there that is churning out these words. How do you compare it with our intelligence? Do you think it's totally something different, where the probabilities are being used and next word is being recommended, and then next word is being recommended, and then next word is being recommended, and here we go, we have an essay?
I'm delighted by your question, and it's a delicate and a difficult one. There's a couple of ways to respond to it, one of which is your perception of your own and our collective human intelligence may be illusory, and you ain't so damn smart after all. and I include myself in that that characterization. As a child, if you think about the newborn, they gradually understand the difference between their environment and themselves. And although they're hardwired for recognizing the face and voice of their mother and the breast, they gradually start to understand that their behavior generates a different behavior and part of the environment around them. And the first things they're doing is sort of at the level of predicting the next word. And it gets to be more and more complicated that you get a more and more sophisticated theory about your environment. You're predicting a bunch of things that are going to happen in your environment. And so my argument is that fundamentally, the complexity of the growing child, an adolescent, a toddler, and then an adolescent, and then a young adult, is years and years of experimenting by saying, if this happens, then that happens, and developing a kind of a theory of the world around them that now is represented in the complexity of these mathematical models. So I think it is very human-like intelligence. And as humans make mistakes, these systems hallucinate. And that's one of the more fascinating aspects of it. Kevin Roos is a journalist at the New York Times and famously had an adventure with Microsoft's Bard, which was originally called Sydney when it was being developed. And Sydney and Kevin spent an evening talking to each other, and at one point Sydney said, your wife doesn't love you, you don't love your wife, divorce her and marry me. He wrote about it famously that this machine was threatening his marriage, and it became a meme and a very public and widely discussed issue. I assigned that original article to my students. And just a few days ago, Kevin, now a year later, returned to say, the instructions at OpenAI was save Kevin's marriage, stop these systems from doing this. And he says, as a result, it's pretty boring, pretty dull. And his I don't know if it was the headline writer or Kevin that came up with the line, AI has become an office drudge and is much less exciting and not hallucinating like it used to. And I sort of miss the old character. So you've mentioned Elon Musk. Musk started his own version of a large language model called Grok. And his notion was, let's keep it funky and experimental. Roos argues that even Grok is not as exciting as it could be, but there is a concept in AI called temperature, and you get to set the temperature, which is how adventurous and risk-taking the response will be. So apparently there's ways in which these matrices can be tuned to be more or less adventurous, and if you want to say, I'm open to you guys making some mistakes, but let's see how creative and weird you can be, and so that's a now an option, a literal temperature control you've got when you enter into the world of communicating with a large language model.
Very interesting. Russ, we are discussing your book, Evolutionary Intelligence, How Technology Will Make Us Smarter. And we have discussed your concept of evolutionary intelligence. Now, in the book, then you talk about some of the fascinating technologies that are being developed now, and you just give us a flavor of the things to come. You talk about this direct machine-brain interface. Why you thought it was important to mention this in this book, and what are your expectations with this new fascinating technology that is perhaps knocking at the door?
Okay, I will start again with a story. The story starts with the invention of the computer in the 1930s and 40s, when the computer was made out of vacuum tubes and occupied an entire room. And then it got shrunk down to a PDP-11 refrigerator-sized computer, and then a desktop, and then a laptop, and now a handheld, or sometimes a watch extension. And so the Moore's law is leading to the reduction in the size and the increase of power of these computational resources. And so it's moving towards our body. And I think although it's not yet successful, there will be a very convenient form of glasses that will allow an overlay as you look at the world around you that will enhance the capacity of this collective intelligence system to label and identify elements in your environment that you might not be aware of or fully understand. Ultimately, perhaps contact lenses. And I'm going to stop it in my own thinking about this at the level of contact lenses and things that are exterior to the human body. Your friend Elon Musk, however, feels otherwise, and his company, also in San Francisco, named Neuralink, wants to actually cut through the skin on the human skull and implant inside the brain a digital interface, and will do so originally to try to enhance the capacity of individuals who are limited in their mobility because of various accidents or other limitations to move a limb or a leg. I think in cases like that where there's really a fundamental disability, it may be viable. But I mention it because it's being thought about and experimented with. I think we can do so much using the human senses of ears and eyes that you don't need to cut open the brain to connect directly to the brain itself.
Even if you think that a different approach should be adopted, but are you positive, are you optimistic that one day we will have direct human-machine connection?
I suppose the impulse of inventors and scientists is to try to see if that can be done safely and productively. But that's going to be a long way off, and here's the metaphor I use to explain it. Our understanding of how the human brain works is so limited. I use the metaphor, if you're trying to understand what's going on inside the human brain, it's like trying to understand a football game while standing outside of the stadium, and you can hear the cheering, and you sort of know, well, something happened, you're not quite sure which team or what. A soccer goal or a football touchdown. And so right now we've got the capacity to measure blood flow and electronic wave functions in the brain. But our capacity to connect either of those things with actual thoughts is so partial that we're still outside the field of play. So connecting to the brain would make sense if we understood what's going on inside the brain, and we don't. Remember, 100 billion neurons, each of which is connected to many thousands of other neurons. So it's not just 100 billion, it's 100 billion times at least 1,000, maybe 10,000 different connections. So that's of a magnitude that it's sort of hard to imagine. I go through exercises with my students to try to say, maybe you can understand a megabyte, maybe a terabyte, but what the hell is a zettabyte? And when you get that many zeros, and through evolution, the human brain, it functions, and the brains of many other animals function in very successful ways to interpret the environment around them. Here's a chance for us to do it, and I think you can do it without actually cutting into the human brain.
Let us move on to a few other points that you touch upon in the book. And technology is already part of our lives. Everywhere, communication, our day-to-day jobs, our commutes, everywhere, technology is there. But this is a new type of technology, artificial intelligence. So if it is successfully developed, we will start using that extensively and our dependence on that technology will immensely increase. Then you talk about the issues, societal challenges, like privacy, like ethical aspects of that. Do you think that our notions of privacy and our notions of I am in charge of everything that I do, so are we too protective? Maybe we will have to let some of these things go. Or do you think that technology will be designed in such a way that these concerns will be addressed and mitigated?
Well, I start out, I have a theory about how our notion of privacy may evolve. I hope it will in this direction. And that is the notion of a personal privacy agent, intelligent agent, that will negotiate on our behalf. And I start off this with my students by saying, well, if you think about all the digital ads you get, how much is that personal information that you have worth in a given year? And if you take the total number of billions of dollars in digital direct focused advertising, and the number of, in the case of America, American adults online, it's about $200 billion and about 200 million Americans. So your personal information in Western Europe and in the U.S. is probably worth about $1,000 a year to advertisers. Now, I figure, well, how about if you let the programmers have $500 and make that available to you to decide whether you want to make your information available? And you say, look, I value my privacy. I'll forego $500 just to make sure nobody knows anything about what I'm buying and what I'm doing and where I live. And that's a reasonable choice. And the other person says, I don't care if somebody knows I like Italian shoes and dark chocolate. And they'll say, okay, and I'll take my $500 in cash, please. And so this, the notion that you could, every time a ad comes onto your browser, make a determination as to whether the information ought to be or should not be sent would require a great deal of effort. But AI can do that for you with your guidance. And so the notion of a automated privacy agent, I think, is one of the promises of AI.
So you are predicting or perhaps suggesting a new type of marketplace where we can actually sell our personal data.
Or not sell it, depending on, or sell part of it, or say, here's some things I don't mind people knowing, and here's some other things I'd rather keep private. And that kind of intelligent negotiation. Right now, there is a phenomenon known as programmatic advertising, where a marketplace is set up so that when you express an interest in a particular food or a particular form of entertainment, that information is very valuable to other people that are selling that food or that product or that entertainment. So there's a marketplace that sells that information saying, I've got a hot client who's just been searching for this very sort of thing. And so all of those transactions take place in a fraction of a second as one computer talks to another computer and the money changes hands and the information. So many of your listeners will have the phenomenon of they're searching for something and then they go on a completely different website and all of a sudden the same sort of product shows up in an ad, and that's a result of the programmatic advertising marketplace. And in order for us to deal humanly with that marketplace, we need an intelligent agent of our own. So far, nobody's made that available, but I think if they did, there'd be plenty of buyers.
And then there is another argument here also that, as you just mentioned, that some of this information about us is already there and we have no control and it is being used for advertisement and for other purposes. So perhaps having some control and giving us the option to make a decision that we want to make this information about ourselves available or not, perhaps this is not a bad idea.
I hope it's a good idea, and I hope that the fact that somebody says, gee, you know, maybe I can start a business allowing for intelligent privacy rather than just selling products and become a intermediary between those that want to sell something and those that potentially may want to buy something and don't mind getting the information brought to them.
Now, let's move on. In one of the chapters of the book, you talk about some new ideas. You talk about digital law, you talk about cyber finance and employment. But there is one term that is stuck in my mind when I looked at that chapter, and I would very much like you to explain that to us and help us to understand that. Intelligent romance. What do you mean by that?
There's some data in the book that I ran across that is stunning to me. It turns out that humans in finding a partner for life have drawn very heavily on family connections, church. More than a few people met their future spouse at a bar. Let's call that a social occasion. And so you could trace for the last, 100 years in industrialized Western Europe and North America, the various settings at which two people found each other. And starting with the 1990s and the early 2000s, the online dating, where people put forward a presentation of themselves, where their weight is lower than it really is, and their income is higher than it really is, and everybody knows that. And we have measures of each of those things now. And that may be the same as to what you say at a bar or even in church when you describe yourself. So maybe that hasn't changed. And so it turns out that this is an issue where you can find people you wouldn't otherwise find, because the number of potential mates at the bar or at the church might be a lot fewer than those that would otherwise be seeking friendship or love online. So that now the majority of people who have bonded and become partners and often married is now from online dating.
I just want to stay with this for a few more moments. If I just move into the realm of poetry and literature, romance is something, it's a matter of heart, what it has to do with intelligence.
Well, that I was using romance there for finding a partner. I'm now provoked by your thoughtful question to say, well, what about all the other elements of romance and poetry and the arts? And I'm moved to say, when we consider this a tool, a resource, then somebody that's trying to create some art. I had some colleagues. I'm a musician, and many of my colleagues would do a lot of songwriting. And let me tell you, a rhyming dictionary is a real help for a songwriter. You can think of a few rhymes, but it's kind of helpful when somebody else, when you've got that resource. So we've now, for many years, had rhyming dictionaries to help us rhyme. I'm thinking that these newly intelligent ways of analyzing, as you know and have probably played with some of these ChatGPT models, you can ask them to respond in a Shakespearean or a nursery rhyme or another flavor of presentation. And they've picked up a lot on that. And I think if we use those creatively as augmenting our creativity, that's a positive way of dealing with art and indeed romance.
Towards the end of the book, you touch upon various points that we should be mindful of and various things that we should do so that artificial intelligence systems developed in such a way that they make us smarter. So various debates are going on, various things are happening. In EU, they are developing some regulations. How do you think that we should work at societal level, work with these large organizations that are developing these systems, work with our lawmakers who are very much concerned about that, how we should work together so that what you are suggesting in this book, that these technologies will make us smarter, that actually happens?
Well, there's one effort that is part of the public concern and public debate about AI systems, and that's the issue of transparency. And the notion is, as best as we can, and there's limits for all of us to try to make sense of a 100 billion parameter mathematical model. But I think a crude notion of regulating, where you have to go to the government to get permission to build an AI system, is misguided and unlikely to be successful. A AI system is basically a mathematical model, and you can't regulate math. I've characterized this with another metaphor, which is trying to regulate math is like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. It's the notion of censorship or prohibition is not likely to work. I think paying close attention, requiring as much as is practical and possible for transparency, makes a lot of sense. The movement in the EU, the so-called AI Act that was recently formalized just actually months ago, focuses a lot on the privacy issue, which has been characteristic of European regulatory style for many decades. And it deals largely with the issue of facial recognition and privacy applications of AI. And I think that's an appropriate and watchful direction that merits it. But my basic argument is that if somebody uses AI to commit a crime, you want to you want to arrest the perpetrator of the crime for the crime, not the tool. So if a bank robber takes a cab to the bank to do the robbery, you don't arrest the cabbie and impound the cab. Go after and there are so many laws already on the books across the world identifying illegal activities. Those laws work just fine, and if someone uses AI in the process of committing one of those acts, arrest the perpetrator, not the AI designer.
Russ, we are discussing your book, Evolutionary Intelligence, How Technology Will Make Us Smarter. We have touched upon a number of topics that you discuss in this book. Obviously, there is much more in the book. However, is there anything else that you think we should touch upon before we close this discussion?
Well, it turns out that the whole issue of AI is very much a moving target. And so I use lots of physical examples of the way in which algorithms, which are more or less AI infused, are all around us every day. And so my message and my conclusion in the book is keep looking under the hood. You want to have these technologies empower you and not take over the power from you.
Professor W. Russell Newman, thank you very much for being with me. It has been an absolute pleasure having you on Bridging the Gaps.
Thank you so much.
Thank you and goodbye.